Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today CQ Magazine for the month of December 2011. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard S. Mawson. Amateur radio call W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handicap System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handicam members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handicams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And for our purposes, Handyham is always spelled in lowercase H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word. So it's handyham@courage, C-O-U-R-A-G-E, .org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's begin in our usual spot today, ham radio news. United States population for ham radio tops 700,000. For the first time ever, there are more than 700,000 licensed radio amateurs in the United States. As of September 30, 2011, according to the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, the total number of FCC amateur licenses was 700,221. This represents a 145% increase over the U.S. ham population in 1971, according to the ARRL, and an increase of more than 200,000 in the past 20 years. After dipping between 2003 and 2007, license numbers have risen steadily for the past 4-plus years, passing the 2003 peak of 687,860 in March of 2010, according to statistics tracked by Joe Speroni, amateur call AH0A. ARRL-VEC manager Maria Soma, AB1FM, says there are currently approximately 150 ARRL-coordinated exam sessions each week throughout the United States, of course, compared with about 55 per week in the mid-1980s. And an editor's note, keep these numbers in mind next time someone tells you ham radio is dying. ARRL at the White House. Three representatives of the American Radio Relay League recently briefed members of the White House National Security Staff on amateur radio's capabilities in an emergency. The September 12th meeting, according to the ARRL letter, was organized by White House Cyber Security Coordinator Howard A. Schmidt, W7HAS, ARRL President K. Craigie, K3KN, Chief Executive Officer David Sumner, K1ZZ, and Emergency Preparedness Manager Mike Corey, W5MPC, made a presentation focusing on amateur radio's capabilities to provide internet messaging connectivity when normal infrastructure has been damaged or destroyed. Meanwhile, though, Newsline reports the FCC and FEMA, F-E-M-A, that's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, jointly issued a set of tips to citizens for keeping lines of communications open during emergency, but did not include any mention of personal two-way radio services, such as amateur radio, CB, or the Family Radio Service. The acronym for that is FRS. Hams help in Thai flooding. Ask for clear frequencies. The Radio Amateur Society of Thailand, RAST, was asking amateurs around the world in mid-October to keep open frequencies in the 40-meter band being used for flood relief communications in the wake of the country's worst flooding in over 60 years. The ARRL reports that 7.060 to 7.063 megahertz are being used for emergency communications, along with 3 2-meter frequencies. Now, the next piece of news is about Spratly Islands. Those of you who might have contributed some of your well-earned and cherished funds to that de-expedition will want to hear that the donations made to support the now canceled DX0DX expedition to the Spratly Islands will be refunded in full, according to Newsline. In an email to the news service, team leader Chris Dmitriovich, VK3FY, said he would personally make up any shortfalls between amounts donated and funds on hand in the expedition account. The long-planned de-expedition was canceled due to personal safety concerns. If you have any questions about this, they may be directed via email to the following, chris@vk3fy.com. Here's some good news on the news line. Danish study, no link between cell phones and cancer. The largest study yet of possible connections between cell phones and cancer has found no evidence of any link. The Associated Press reported in October that the Danish study of more than 350,000 cell phone users monitored over 17 years found that there was no increase in cancer risk compared with non-cell phone users. In the United States, both the Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Communications Commission have found no evidence of a link. Fears of a connection persist, however, the story reported, despite the fact that cancer rates have not increased since cell phones were introduced. Ham radio satellite milestones. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the launch of Oscar One. Good old Oscar. The first amateur radio satellite and the first non-government satellite ever placed in orbit. In addition, October marked the 30th anniversary of the launch of USAT-1, built by the University of Surrey in England. According to the AMSAT News Service, UO-9 was the first amateur satellite to carry an onboard computer, to have battery and altitude management capabilities, a CCD camera, and other features that became the foundation for amateur satellite technology in future years. DXCC offers special update procedure for ST0R, Sierra Tango Zero Romeo QSLs. With paper QSL cards from ST0R, the expedition to South Sudan just beginning to arrive in DXers mailboxes in mid-October, the ARRL is offering DXCC members a special one-time deal to update their country totals with the ST0R card only before the update deadline on December 31. The offer is only good for those hams who have already made at least one submission to DXCC during 2011. You can find complete details about that on the ARRL website. U.S. postal rates increasing on January 22, 2012. The cost of a first-class stamp will increase by a penny to 45 cents as of January 22, 2012. Rates to Canada and Mexico are increasing a nickel to 85 cents, and other international destinations will be $1.05, an increase of 7 cents, according to the United States Postal Service. In addition, the cost of mailing a postcard will go up 3 cents to 32 cents. That's the second postcard rate increase in less than a year. Dayton's 2012 theme, Internationally Connected. Planners of the Dayton Hamvention have chosen Internationally Connected as the show's theme for 2012. According to the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, which sponsors the three-day event each May, this year's choice was made to recognize the many hams who travel to Dayton from all over the world and to acknowledge, quoting, the important role that ham radio plays in promoting international goodwill, close quote. DARA, D-A-R-A, that's the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, has set up a new committee specifically to work with foreign guests. The 2012 Hamvention will be held from May 18 through 20. The show brings about 20,000 people a year to the Dayton area and generates some $10 million in revenue for the region. Here's a bit more to excite the amateur radio community. Ham Band at 500 kilohertz, a step closer. An international amateur radio allocation around 500 kilohertz moved a step closer to fruition in late September as a key committee of the Council of European Post and Telecommunications Authority, CEPT, approved a draft proposal for a secondary amateur allocation between 472 and 480 kilohertz KHZ. According to the Southgate Amateur Radio Club's website, the approval means that the 48 member countries of CEPT will back the proposal, which was drafted by the Radio Society of Great Britain. Ham groups are still hoping for a 15 kilohertz wide allocation, but feel this agreement is a good start. Meanwhile, another SEP committee recommended that member countries work to establish a uniform set of guidelines for administering amateur radio license exams to people with disabilities. One last piece of information. Amateur call K3HDO, Kilo Alpha 3, Hotel Delta Oscar, retires from NASA. Frank Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, amateur call K3HDO, a key player in getting amateur radio aboard the International Space Station, has retired from NASA after a 36-year career with the space agency. His final post was as chief engineer of the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters. Over the years, he worked on a variety of human and robotic space missions as well as many other programs and experiments. He was also AMSAT's vice president of human space flight programs from 1991 to 2009 and served as ARIS, that's amateur radio on the International Space Station, program leader and chair of the ARIS International Working Group. So there you have the amateur radio news on the publication of CQ Magazine for December 2011. It just goes to show that was a rather lengthy commentary this time that there's a lot happening in the wonderful hobby of ham radio. For those of you who listen for the announcements regarding special event stations which are scheduled for the next month or two, let's get right to that. The list is relatively short because, I suppose, of the holiday season. Radio amateur station WX3MAS from Nazareth and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to celebrate the holidays from the twin Christmas cities of Nazareth and Bethlehem, the Christmas City Amateur Radio Club and the Delaware Lehigh Amateur Radio Club sponsored event. December 10 and 11 from 1400 UTC to 0200 UTC, that's international time, the station will be on 28.465, 21.365, 14.265, 7.270, and 3.850 megahertz. Depending on conditions, it will also operate on PSK31 on 20 and 40 meters, and 10 and 15 meters if band conditions permit. If you listen to them, even as a shortwave listener, and you'd like to have a very colorful commemorative certificate, you can send your QSL card or at least a request in a 9x12 self-addressed stamped envelope to Christmas City Amateur Radio Club, RR8, Greystone Building, Nazareth, Pennsylvania, PA, zip code 18064. Another special event call, WD4WDW, that's Whiskey Delta 4, Whiskey Delta Whiskey from Orlando, Florida, to commemorate the 110th birthday of, want to guess? Walt Disney from Disney World. DEARS, that's the Disney Emergency Amateur Radio Service, December 10th from 1000 UTC to 2200 UTC. On 14.260, 7.260, and 28.360 megahertz. For an 8x10 certificate, send an SASE to DEARS, DEARS, P.O. Box 22346, 22346, Orlando, Florida, zip code 32830, 1-800-273-0. And if you'd like to take a look at their website, it's www.wd4wdw.org. Folks, we've been talking quite a bit the last several months about CQ Communications going digital and going online with its different publications. Here's a digital connection by Don Rotundo, N2IRZ, a user's guide for CQ Goes Digital. In case you missed the last issue, I'll repeat what's been big news here at CQ Magazine. We've gone digital. As of the November 2011 issue, CQ Amateur Radio Magazine is available online as well as in print in what I call an enhanced digital format. This month, I'd like to talk about this new format, how to use the online reader, and some of the enhancements we'll be seeing. Digital publishing isn't new. I've been getting several magazines in digital format for years. Digital versions are nice for most publications because I don't need to store mounds of paper anymore. I can print most anything on demand, and I can search hundreds of issues for the information I need. For readers outside the United States of America, postage costs are no longer a concern, allowing subscriptions without the postage surcharge that often doubles the price. As with most anything, some implementations are better than others. One publication, the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Packet Status Register, is essentially a higher-end club newsletter. It is published as an Adobe Acrobat PDF, that's a portable document format file, which is downloaded and read in the free and ubiquitous Acrobat Reader. The PDF files show text and images very well and have capabilities for embedded hyperlinks and bookmarks, but real multimedia is a little bit tricky. Also a great concern to some publishers, the files can be easily copied and shared, perhaps too easily. When non-subscribers have access to the same content as subscribers, what is the incentive to subscribe? Well, this isn't such a concern for a nonprofit such as TARP, a publication such as Reader's Digest or CQ, might not be able to withstand the potential revenue loss. Putting a magazine out into the digital world is also not as simple as posting a file online. One must deal with subscriptions and renewals, verifying that a particular user is entitled to view the magazine. A robust search engine is essential. Subscribers should be able to print articles easily and with good resolution, as well as perhaps some convenient way to actually view the magazine online. All this while ensuring good performance even for those on limited speed internet connections. Viewing print information on a computer is such an old topic that it's almost trivial. Acrobat Reader is well known and quite mature in its feature set. Being a free download doesn't hurt either, and surely that's the secret to its marketing dominance today. However, things can be even better than that. Ever use a Kindle? It's an ebook reading service that looks a lot like a tablet computer sold by Amazon. My daughter bought one for herself last year for just over $100. To download content, she just goes to Amazon.com, picks what she wants, and it downloads automatically via Wi-Fi. Or if you bought the more expensive model, she didn't. She's the daughter of a ham, via the nationwide 3G mobile phone network. The text and images look like a book, and nothing like a computer screen. Feel like a book, a little larger than a paperback. Endure, almost like a book, ghosts about a month between battery charges. And most important of all, works like a book. To turn pages, you just flick the button at the edge of the unit. The point I'm trying to make is that ease of use is very important. If you can't figure out how to use it, or even worse, find using it inconvenient, you won't use it, and eventually it will be one more piece of hardware gathering dust. The Kindle folks have certainly given this a lot of thought, and what they came up with is highly user-friendly. In a case of CQ Magazine, we decided to have a company called Zinio, that's spelled Z-I-N-I-O, host our digital edition. It specializes in online content and says it is, quoting, the world's largest newsstand and bookstore, close quote. And although Zinio is great at all the back-end stuff, like managing the access and indexing, its real crown jewel is its Zinio Unity, that's a trademark, a reading platform. On a computer, as expected, content is excellent, but you can get the same content for almost any mobile device, such as the iPad, iPhone, or Android-powered device. Platform independence is now an important feature. As little as 6 years ago, browsing the internet while mobile was uncommon, like the early days of the cell phone, say 1987, when only a select few, and somewhat wealthy, folks had cellular mobile telephones. In 2005, few had a good mobile internet browsing solution. Today, in 2011, it's nearly 2012, it is getting difficult to find a mobile phone that does not have internet capabilities. In a business world, more companies are paying attention to social media, another new internet phenomena. People are using their mobile devices to enhance more and more of their daily lives. Whether it's watching TV shows on Hulu.com or checking with the Google Maps to find where that new Krispy Kreme store is, you have to admit, it's really convenient to have a tiny computer in your pocket. And reading the latest issue of CQ on your iPad or iPhone or Android phone or PC or Mac while on the train into the city is just another thing that the next generation will take for granted. Therefore, let's take a look at the Zinio Unity Reader. I'll use one of its free samples as an example. Zinio also has free subscriptions, but most, like CQ, will cost you. To view an example, I went to www.zinio.com, scrolled to the bottom of the page, clicked About Us, and then selected the Experience Zinio Firsthand link near the center of the page. In my case, I got to look at the November 2011 issue of Popular Mechanics. At the time I'm writing this, CQ wasn't yet available. Darn those print lead times. Looking at Figure 1 along the bottom, we have, from left to right, Print, Preferences, Help, Share, Search, Full Screen Mode, Zoom, Table of Contents, Thumbnail View, and Page Back and Forward. Each magazine's publisher determines what Print, Share, and Search options will be available. Print is about as simple as it can get. You get to print a current page or pages, print all, or print a selected page range. Preferences allows you to set the page view and orientation, as well as turn the menu on and off in full screen mode. The Help feature opens a new window so you don't lose the document page you're viewing, and offers several help features, such as help with your account and some frequently asked questions, FAQs. The Share option is not available on CQ publications. All content is available only to subscribers and single-issue purchases. The Search feature wasn't working in the sample I tried, but I am told that this is a function of the publisher's settings. The magazine's publisher provides whatever is in the search catalog, which can be anything from a full-text search to just simple keywords. Full screen mode is just that. It fits the entire page, or two pages, on your screen without any browser frame. The menu on the bottom can be set to appear or not in your preferences, as I mentioned earlier. Zoom is astounding. You can zoom in so close that only about one-tenth of the page is visible. Really handy if you want to see some detail in a photo or drawing, or I suppose if you don't want to use your eyeglasses to read, like me. Table of Contents is handy, since it not only brings you right to the table of contents, naturally, but the TOC is a bunch of links. A single click brings you to the first page of any article or column. If you want a quick overview or need to scan several pages at once, the thumbnail view helps you do that, as you can see in Figure 2. Scroll around until you find the page and then click to go there. You can also click at the top of the toolbar and open up a scrolling thumbnail view along the bottom, which speeds navigation. Last are the page back and page forward buttons. This is the one tool that I have not found all that useful, since clicking the edge of a page just moves the view forward or back. I don't have an iPad or iPhone, but I am told that Xenio has fully implemented the flick motion control to turn pages and do other things. If you don't know what that means, you need to stop by an Apple store and play with an iPad. There's a reason why they are so popular. As you can see, the toolbar is straightforward and simple to use. The Xenio designers had a major focus on ease of use, since readers are not just the Gen Y tech-savvy youngsters toting their iPads, but also include grandma and grandpa, who really prefer paper but like the portability and bigger text you get electronically. However, that menu is only a tiny part of the whole. Yes, it is easy to use, but how is what you're reading online any different from that paper magazine your friendly postal worker delivered? The short answer is a lot. Electronic media opens up a whole new world in the way that content can be delivered. For us CQ columnists, it means we have to adjust to a new way of thinking. Forget the flat world of paper, because the whole rich multimedia experience available on the interweb is now ours to use. As an example, let's say I was writing about the Arduino again and wanted to share some program for controlling an antenna rotor or rotator that I was writing. In the past, I'd either put the actual lines of code into print, relying on you to retype them accurately into your Arduino compiler, or maybe put them onto a website somewhere and send you there to download a file. Well, for the print edition, I'd still have to do that and will, but in the electronic version, any link to a file on the website may be accessed with a simple click. Or let's say I want to show you a special adjustment technique for your 9600 baud packet modem. In the past, I need to rely on words and photographs to tell the story. But now, I can produce a short video and embed it into the electronic version along with a link for our print readers. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but what's a video worth? And that doesn't even get into our new ability to insert even higher resolution images for when the detail is important, or how we can link to just about any kind of file such as sound or animation. For example, I want to hear what PSK31 should sound like. One click. If you're reading this on paper and have a smartphone with QR software installed, try scanning the QR code in Figure 3 instead. As for the details, what it costs, where to subscribe, where to view issues, I'll refer you to the CQ website. That's http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com and or ads elsewhere in this issue. As of this writing, online subscriptions were available for both print subscribers at a discount and online-only subscribers. Go check it out. At the moment, I, and I am sure many of my fellow columnists are in the same boat, am not quite sure what to do with this newfound ability. Should I start producing videos, sound files, load up the column with hyperlinks? After writing since the last century for a flat, familiar, and ancient medium, it will take a few months at least to figure out what works and what doesn't. I'm confident that our editorial staff will help guide all of us as we move into the 21st century. But the folks I really want to hear from are you, my readers and customers. So just this once, start up your email program or put a stamp on an envelope and please let me know what you're thinking. This time it's more important than ever as we shape a new old magazine that does something really spectacular. Print edition readers, rest assured you won't be left behind. All links will be spelled out in each issue so you won't miss out on the action. As is my custom this time of year, when we're all feeling good about home, family, and peace, I wish you and yours all the peace of the season and all year round. VY73 Don. N2IRC. Ladies and gentlemen, on page 20 of the December 2011 CQ magazine, there are the results of the 2011 CQ Worldwide DX 160-meter contests. The author here is Andy Blank, B-L-A-N-K. Andy's call is N2NT. As usual, these kinds of results are very, very lengthy. They include a lot of call signs, a lot of extra material that is probably only very interesting to a reasonably few number of people who might be listening to this publication. So I'm going to give you pretty much the first part of it, which I hope summarizes the importance of the entire matter. And if you want to go further, if you're sight impaired in any way, have one of your friends or companions, check out the CQ magazine for December 2011, beginning on page 20 for the results of the CW, the single sideband, and all the listings of who won and who didn't. But let's begin at the top. The day two spotlight openings in Europe was fantastic, followed by a nice JA opening. That was Japan. This is what makes you come back for more. That was a quote from WD5COV. This was typical of the quotes from many of the operators in the 2011 CQ WWDX 160-meter CW and single sideband contest. We expected scores to be down somewhat given the increase in solar activity, but you couldn't tell it from the results. The band just wouldn't give up. On CW, that's Morse code, there were 40 millionaires, scores over 1 meg. This is down only 8 from 48 in 2010. However, on single sideband, only CN2A was able to break the million-point barrier. It was a challenge on single sideband this year for sure, but the troops still came out in good numbers because 2,391 logs were submitted and 1,183 for single sideband. Special emphasis was put on log checking this year. There is more on that later in the article. Congratulations to Peter, call K3ZM, Kilo 3, Zulu Mike, who just keeps cranking out big scores from his Virginia Salt Marsh QTH location. Peter managed to take the combined CW Slant SSB trophy, showing great dedication to the contest. In some cases, there were higher scores on CW than Peter's combined score. But with no SSB operation, awarding the trophy to the highest CW scoring station was not in the spirit intended. Another notable case was the fabulous operation of CR2X, Charlie Romeo 2 X-ray. The station came in third place worldwide on CW with OH2PM at the helm and the third place worldwide on single sideband with OH2BH operating. With two different operators, we felt the combined trophy should go to the operator and not the station. Also making the top 10 on both modes was 4Oscar3Alpha403A, Ranko Superstation with the man himself at the key on CW, and YQ1YV, Yankee Uniform 1, Yankee Victor, operating on single sideband. There are many trophies available in this contest thanks to the generosity of numerous donors. Some categories have very few entrants, and we encourage you to get on the air and give the contest a try. You never know when you will get some wood for the wall. A good example is the tale of YC1COZ, who said, "My antenna was broken in the day to morning by strong wind. Hi, hi." He made only one QSO, but won the single operator Oceana Trophy. We need more stations like that to give top band a try. More countries equals more fun for everyone. And then the article goes on about the results for both CW and single sideband, if you're interested. And while we're in the business of announcing results, we'll also announce the next big contest sponsored by CQ Magazine, the 2012 CQDX Marathon. The 2012 edition of the CQDX Marathon begins at 0 UTC on January 1, 2012 and runs through 2359 UTC, that's world time, on December 31, 2012, a full solid 1 year. The goal, as always, is to work as many countries and CQ zones as possible at least once during the calendar year. There are no significant changes to the rules this year, but there will be a significant increase in the number of plaques awarded. Sincere thanks to our new sponsors. We will continue to use the downloadable Microsoft Excel template or equivalent, which may be filled in and emailed to a special address as your log entry. Conversion programs are available to automatically populate the template from your logging program. The CQDX Marathon is a one-year-long activity, as I've just stated. Now, regarding the frequencies, any authorized amateur frequency may be used. Contacts through repeaters or satellites are not allowed for credit, nor are contacts with maritime or aeronautical mobile stations. All contacts must be made entirely over amateur radio frequencies. For example, Echolink-type contacts do not count. Submissions with all contacts utilizing a single band will be recognized. Now, as regards the modes, any authorized amateur mode may be used. Three modes will be recognized in the DX Marathon: CW, single sideband, and digital. All modes other than CW or voice will count as digital. Submissions with all contacts utilizing a single mode will be recognized. Further details for this contest continue on page 28, 29, and beyond. So, again, if you're into the contesting thing, please, by all means, go check out the 2012 CQDX Marathon information. I think it's time for a change of pace. Let's take a look at Kids Corner. The author is Brittany Decker. Call KB1OGL, Kilo Bravo 1 Oscar Golf Lima. Brittany titles this one, "The Unseen Kid Heroes." It begins on page 60. Up next is the BlackBerry Blackout and how we've become so dependent on them, said the news anchor one evening. The blackout of BlackBerry phones experienced a couple of months ago is just one example of how modern technology is not completely flawless, as some may think. The people who know this best are often amateur radio operators, including some young hams who appreciate both the commercially wired world and our amateur wireless one. One of these young hams is a 15-year-old Brendan Tenold, T-E-N-O-L-D. Brendan's amateur call is KD0KMT. After discovering a post on QRZ.com about his winning the South Dakota State Fair in the electronics category for a repeater he built, I talked to Brendan over the phone. Despite being totally at home with Facebook, cell phones, and other forms of social media, Brendan is a dedicated radio operator. A homeschooled student in South Dakota, Brendan has delved headfirst into the world of radio. Quoting here, "It basically revolves around my world. My whole life is radio," he said of the hobby. Brendan first got into amateur radio when his friend Larry Miller, WA0BDN, showed him his own personal ham shack. Brendan got himself a handheld radio and started listening while he began to study for his test. His dad also decided to get his license at the same time. Quoting again, he decided he'd get it so that if I made a mistake, he could help me, and so he could get on there and talk, just so he can talk. And he was up all night on the computer taking the practice test. And get this, we got the same answers wrong, and the VE noticed, but we were on the opposite ends of the room. Since getting his license, much of what Brendan does to succeed is through radio-related activities. An example is the contests that Brendan won. He participated in a Harding County Fair, in which his repeater won first prize, and he went on to compete in the State Fair, in which he also won first prize. Brendan also helps maintain radio equipment for the local fire department. One of his favorite parts of amateur radio is the emergency preparedness aspect. He is very aware of the repeater situation in South Dakota, which is why the repeater he built, which bridged the communication gap between South and North Dakota, won first prize. He hopes to help fix this problem by helping to repair repeaters when possible. He is also looking at becoming a member of ARES, A-R-E-S, the American Radio Relay League's Amateur Radio Emergency Service. Brendan enjoys being a storm spotter, something that is invaluable in his area where there are not many storm spotters. Quoting again, I helped relay information all day about the tornado. They were really happy. I got a few emails about their appreciation for the reports because we are really the only spotters. Of the whole modern technology versus amateur radio debate, Brendan seems to have the perfect balance. He's completely capable of using Skype, Facebook, and cell phones while having a very healthy love and respect for radio's necessity in today's world. I'm more into the emergency part of it, like we had a storm around here and it dropped into a tornado and I was with the National Weather Service all day. Called National Weather Service 200 miles away, and everyone was like, my cell phone doesn't work, the internet doesn't work. Well, of course. Even with friends, Brendan encourages them to at least give radio a try. He says one friend is not ready for the test, but is definitely taking an interest. He has another friend who is asking why not just use Skype to talk. So he gave the friend some coax cable and a beam antenna and used Skype to see each other's faces, but radio to talk on the air. There definitely needs to be a balance between modern commercial technology and amateur radio, because when power goes out, Skype doesn't work, but these two friends can still talk via amateur radio. Brendan also promotes amateur radio through his 4-H club. Quoting, I'm the only one in my 4-H club who's interested in radio, and I bring presentations every 2 weeks and demonstrate if a cell phone doesn't work, how radio can work, and the kids are pretty interested. Brendan does these demonstrations for kids age 5 through 13, a hefty accomplishment to take a hobby that may not be immediately interesting to young kids and make it a routine topic of a 4-H club. As amateur radio has done with many people, I wanted to know if Brendan's love of amateur radio might continue to grow into a career influenced by his hobby. Though only 15 years old, he is thinking about becoming a software engineer, specifically working for Motorola. He has been offered work with the company and described one occasion on which he was asked by someone from Motorola questions as such as, what does a voltage regulator do? And surprised the employee because he knew every answer. Will amateur radio keep living on as a flourishing hobby? With young amateurs such as Brendan Tonode, so full of passion, incredible potential, and looking for ways to improve the world through the hobby, yes, it no doubt will grow. I always like to call amateur radio operators the unseen heroes, people who prepare nearly as much as firefighters or police officers, and who will play just as big a role when disaster strikes. It is kids like Brendan who are the future of emergency preparedness and who will be there at the next attack or the next natural disaster. You're going to have hams there who are ready and prepared and willing to help. When all else fails, we're just there. We're just there. This column will be my last with CQ Magazine. My time at CQ has been one of the best experiences of my life, one that not many people my age have had. As much as I love amateur radio as well as writing about it, I now have to use my time to focus on college auditions and applications. I hope to be accepted to the University of Maryland for the fall semester of 2012, where I plan to double major in jazz piano performance and business management. I would like to thank everyone I have worked with on my columns. It was so much fun to talk to young amateurs all over the country. I'd also like to thank Rich Mawson, W2VU, editor of CQ, for the guidance throughout my time as a writer for CQ. 73, DE, Brittany, KB1OGL. Remember I mentioned that Oscar satellite about 50 years later? So here's a little bit more about it, that VHF Plus column by Joe Lynch, call N6CL. It was 50 years ago this month when amateur radio made its entry into space with Oscar 1. Launched on December 13, 1961, the little satellite lasted in orbit for 22 days, broadcasting the Morse code message dit-dit-dit-dit-dit-dit, which translated from Morse code means hi, H-I. In this column, your editor quotes former columnists who published articles in the January 1995 issue of CQ Magazine in the celebration of CQ's 50th anniversary. These three icons of the past are George Jacob, W3ASK, Bill Orr, W6SAI, now a silent key, and Don Stoner, W6TNS, also a silent key. Here are their words of recollection from that issue. At least part of it, folks. Oscar 1, the world's first ham radio satellite, by Bill Orr, W6SAI. In December 1961, an event occurred that made a deep impact on amateur radio and its place in the world of communication. The first amateur satellite, Oscar 1, a 2-meter beacon, was launched successfully. It was the first non-governmental satellite ever placed in orbit. The road to that launch started almost immediately after Sputnik's launch in 1957. Hams in the aerospace world began thinking about launching an amateur communications satellite. Thoughts were turned into action in 1959 after CQ semiconductor columnist Don Stoner, amateur called W6TNS, wrote about a transistorized 50-milliwatt 2-meter transmitter that he designed. Quoting here, does anyone have a spare rocket for orbiting purposes? He asked. That column led directly to the formation of Project Oscar, O-S-C-A-R, by hams in the San Francisco Bay Area. Their goal was to launch ham radio into space. The launching process was painful and complex in tasking. It required the know-how to build a satellite, the approval of the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, in order to gain political clout, and okay from the Federal Communications Commission, which was bemused by the idea of an unattended U.S. amateur transmitter circling the globe, and finally, the agreement of the U.S. Air Force to launch the satellite on a regularly scheduled space mission. All of this took time and the devotion of many hams both in and out of government. The Oscar launch was from an air base in California, and an agonizing period elapsed until hams at KC4USB in Antarctica heard the satellite on its first pass around the globe. Reception reports poured in from many countries, and the attendant publicity of the experiment encouraged Project Oscar and others to start thinking about a translator, that's a linear repeater, that would permit two-way VHF communication over great distances. Oscar 1 was the forerunner of a spectacular series of ham satellites, growing in complexity and sophistication over the years as hams worldwide joined AMSTAT, that's the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation, the offspring of the Project Oscar. Even though relatively few amateurs took part in the early satellite experiments, their long-term results were profound. The amateur satellite service was recognized internationally, giving status to amateur radio as a whole. Gradually, other nations, led by the Soviet Union, built and launched amateur satellites, leading eventually to live amateur radio in space, with the advent of the continuing series of manned space station launches. The following is from W3ASK on space. In addition to editing CQ's propagation column, George Jacobs, W3ASK, was a pioneer in the development of amateur radio OSCAR satellites and the formation of AMSAT. For many years, he was also editor of CQ's Space Communications column. George Jacobs' contribution is titled CQ in the Space Age. All of us in amateur radio were very excited over the Soviet launching of the first Sputnik satellite in October 1957. Shortly after the Sputnik launch, Don Stoner, W6TNS, in a classic article in CQ, challenged radio amateurs to develop and have launched for them a piggyback radio amateur satellite. An outstanding group of licensed radio amateurs living in California, including some of America's leading satellite engineers and scientists at the time, formed the OSCAR Committee in 1959 to meet this challenge. The name was derived from Orbiting Satellite Carrying Amateur Radio, OSCAR. I joined the OSCAR team as publicist and government contact. This gave birth to CQ's Space Communications column, which made its debut in December 1960 and appeared monthly for 6 years. This was another first for CQ, for no other publication took OSCAR seriously at the time. One of my biggest thrills in amateur radio was the successful launch of OSCAR 1 on December 13, 1961. I still tingle today as I recall hearing the satellite's beacon beep out high, HI, from space in the 2-meter band. CQ has always taken great pride in its leadership in promoting such innovations as single sideband mobile communications, RTTY, that's radio teletype, and amateur space communications. Nowhere is this tradition of leadership more evident than in the story of how CQ got Project OSCAR off the ground. And now some following commentary by Donald L. Stoner, W6TNS. That's high. Each of us, at one time or another, has said something, made a recommendation, or taken an action that has had a profound effect on others. Some, like myself, know the inner thrill of affecting history with nothing more than a simple statement. In the late 50s, I was the semiconductor editor of CQ magazine, the gigahertz-busting devices we employ in our SHF preamps today were just a gleam in the eyes of physicists back in the good old days. In fact, when I started writing the CQ column, silicon and gallium had not been used in those tiny metal miracles. Germanium was the element du jour, and getting a transistor to work at 144 megahertz required an equal mix of skill and black magic incantations, as in, oscillate, damn it! As the decade came to an end, I had pushed up my various transmitter designs from 5 to 10 milliwatts to a rock-crushing 50 milliwatts. Yes, all of 0.05 watts. On a nice summer weekend, my bride and I piled into the family jalopy and headed for WA6EGA's home, away from home, in the San Bernardino Mountains at Running Springs, California. Tony had offered to let me put the tone-modulated beacon and a 38-inch dipole antenna up on the roof of his cabin as an experiment. Lo and behold, my germanium gargantuan was heard in San Diego, 120 miles south, and with an S9 signal strength. That's a very good signal strength. Now you don't have to be a propagation guru to realize that signals from 120 miles straight up should be as good as or better than signals from 120 miles over land. And so it came to pass that I published a circuit for the tiny transmitter in CQ magazine along with the cutesy comment quoting here, "Does anyone have a spare rocket for orbiting purposes?" Close quote. And someone did. No sooner had the magazine hit the mailboxes than I received a call from Fred Hicks, W6EJU, up in Sunnyvale, south of San Francisco. Fred was involved with the Lockheed Amateur Radio Club. He excitedly told me that Lockheed, which had an excellent working relationship with the Air Force, just might be able to inject a beacon into orbit. Talk about skeptical city. Lockheed made and orbited top-secret goodies for the government. Share a ride with something that didn't officially exist? No way, I thought. But thanks to the influence and perseverance of those too numerous to mention, it did happen. And as they say, the rest is history. The moral of the story, guys, is watch what you say. Someone might just take you seriously. And in conclusion, I had been a licensed amateur radio operator for not quite a year when Oscar One was launched. This is the author speaking. I remember the worldwide headlines that it created in the news reports on television. As a junior high student, I was busting with pride when my fellow students asked me about the satellite. Unfortunately, its short lifespan caused it to disappear all too quickly from the world's media. Even so, it was the talk around the local South Bay Amateur Radio Society Club meetings and with the local weak signal operators, which included my friend Herb Adams, K6BTO, the father of my junior high school buddy Frank Adams, WA60AC. So many names in this column are now silent keys. They have passed away, including both of the Adams family I mentioned above. With each passing of our pioneers, it gets a bit harder to recall all of the facts of those events. It is hoped that as you have read this column's reprints of first-person recollections, you also have your recollections, and perhaps you may wish to share some of them in a future issue of this column, your column. Until next month, 73 DE Joe N6 CL. Folks, I'll take a little bit from the next column, Propagation by Thomas Hood, NW7US. It's titled Winter Opportunities on the Bands. Solar activity continues to increase during the latter half of 2011, and the excitement generated among the amateur radio community is infectious. A comparison based on smoothed monthly sunspot numbers for sunspot cycle 23 and cycle 24, with each cycle starting at the month with the lowest sunspot number, that was May 1996 and August 2009, reveals that the current cycle is actually progressing rather typically. While the solar cycle minimum between both cycles was lengthy, it is possible that this new cycle is not in any way defective when compared, at least in this manner. Certainly, when asking the amateur radio community active on 10 meters how this cycle is progressing, you will get a very enthusiastic, very well indeed. Conditions for December should continue in this upward trend. We still are far from the solar cycle maximum. The density of ionization in the northern hemisphere is expected to increase more rapidly after sunrise than during other seasons. Static and atmospheric noise levels will be at seasonally low values during the months. Reasonably strong signal levels are expected on most of the open bands, and the higher bands are becoming ever more active. While improbable, keep a lookout for one or two short 6-meter openings toward the end of December 2011 and into the early part of January 2012. Solar activity may bring a surprise. The daytime openings on 10, 12, and 15 meters will be short, but hold a lot of promise with paths into more areas of the world. Not just on northerly, southerly paths. 10 meters showed great performance as early as the end of September, but especially during October with openings into many areas of the world. This continues as we enter into winter. During much of the daylight hours, especially where the propagation paths cross the sunlit regions, expect 10 and 12 meter DX openings. Fairly good DX openings are also expected on 17 and 15 meters, remaining open toward the west during the early evening. Starting with early morning, expect strong openings on 20 meters in all directions until about an hour or two after sunrise, and then into one place or another through the day until early evening. The 30-meter band will not be a strong player for DXing during the daytime, but will come alive closer to the night hours. So, folks, this is Bob, your reader. In summary, what it's telling us is that this sunspot cycle 24, which we've been struggling to get to work better for us humans, that is, with amateur radio intent to call and talk and dit-dot all over the world, is really getting better. The author goes on to talk about VHF conditions, meteor showers, and the current sunspot cycle progress in more detail. But we've come to the magic witching hour. It's over an hour now that you have been listening to me. So I want to take this moment to stop and conclude the commentary from CQ Magazine for December 2011. As you all know, this is really a digest reading of a lot of material in the magazine, or all of the amateur magazines that we read for you on the Courage Handyhem system and other areas. So as we go along and I cut and paste and try to give everybody a little bit of something interesting, I hope you forgive me if I come close to boring some of you who don't want all the details. You know, the truth of the matter is amateur radio, tremendous hobby. But you have to know a little bit about it. Once you get involved, you really start to feel the excitement of it. Things like Oscar, the Oscar satellite. But anyway, have a great holiday season. I hope everything is great for you toward the end of the year, and that New Year shows us a much brighter future, not only for amateur radio, the sunspot cycle, and of course the world community, which seems to be in constant turmoil nowadays. I've been reading for CQ Magazine for December 2011. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications, Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor, Richard S. Mawson, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyhem System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyhem members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, maintained every day, a great bit of information there for all to enjoy, is www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks a lot again for listening along with me here on the Courage Handyhem System. Happy New Year!